Good. We have one final section in differential geometry before we move on to Einstein's equations. Trying to find a dry board. So this is section 2.3, curves, and GD6. One, covariant differentiation. Along a curve. So far, we've dealt with tensors that are defined over all of space-time. And so we denote their argument by t of x, suppressing indices, just some tensor t of x. But sometimes interested in tensors defined only over a curve. X mu of some parameter s. So we have some particle, for example, moving in space-time, parameter s along the curve. And the tensor may be defined only along the curve. The classic example would be the four velocity. Which is d x mu of s ds, which is sometimes called u mu of s. So we want to know how to define covariant derivatives of such tensors. First, I need an eraser. When I get to that point, it's probably better to stick with this one, isn't it? So let's consider some vector a mu of s and a prime mu is dx mu dx mu a mu of s. Indices should be up. So d a mu prime of s is dx prime mu dx nu times dA nu of s ds. That's one term.
Would you mind clarifying quickly what you're representing in the first line?
This is a vector defined along the curve, A mu of s, and I've given you its transformation rule under a coordinate transformation, x goes to x prime. That would make it a vector, but then there's another term. D2 x prime mu dx nu dx lambda times dx lambda ds a nu of s. So this is not a tensor. Now, we've already had some experience of what to do in this situation. We define a covariant derivative, which I'm going to call capital D, A mu of s, ds, which will be defined to be the ordinary derivative, which is not a tensor, plus another term, which is also not a tensor, gamma mu rho sigma dx rho by ds a sigma. That is a tensor. And that's what we mean by the covariant derivative along a curve. Now, that's the upstairs version. There's a downstairs version, d mu of s ds equals d b mu of s ds minus gamma rho mu nu dx nu ds b rho. Now let's look at an example of the four velocity. Excuse me. And we recognize this as the geodesic equation. So the geodesic equation can be summarized by saying the covariant derivative of the four velocity is equal to zero. And this brings us on to the topic of geodesic deviation. You remember our flat earth baseballs fall keeping themselves parallel, whereas for a round Earth, they would both fall towards the center of the Earth and would be seen to be drawn closer together. This phenomenon then is called geodesic deviation. This is an example of geodesic deviation. And we can express it mathematically by looking at comparing two infinitesimally close geodesics. So we start with this equation, and then we consider the trajectory x mu of S and a neighboring trajectory x mu of S plus delta x mu of S. But this is some infinitesimal difference between the two geodesics. So this means applied we take the same equation now for x plus delta x, and then we keep terms first order in delta x. So keep terms of order delta x and subtract the first equation. This one, and we get an equation for delta x. And it turns out to be d2x mu ds squared plus gamma mu rho sigma comma alpha delta x alpha dx rho by ds dx sigma by ds plus twice gamma mu rho sigma dx rho by ds dx sigma by ds is equal to zero. Now this can be rearranged to make it obviously a tensor equation. It says the second derivative, the second covariant derivative of x mu with respect to S is equal to the Riemann tensor R mu rho alpha sigma delta x alpha dx rho by ds, dx sigma by ds. So what does this equation tell us? When the Riemann tensor is zero, the paths are indeed parallel. That's what the equation d2s, d2 by ds squared equals zero means. They stay in a straight line. But when the Riemann tensor is non-zero, there's a deviation, which we can see in this example of the baseballs falling to the center of the Earth. So once again, the criterion for whether there's deviation or not is whether the space-time is curved or not, and that is whether the Riemann tensor is zero or not. So once again, the Riemann tensor plays the all-important role. Let's just look at, we've talked a lot about the Riemann tensor. It's of absolutely vital importance in Einstein's theory. It's good to get a feel for what it means. So let's do a little simple calculation. Of Riemann. Let's suppose we have a sphere. That means ds squared is dz1 squared plus dz2 squared plus dz3 squared subject to z squared equals a squared. This gives, in other words, a squared is d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So if we have three coordinates and we subject them to a constraint that the sum of the squares, by which I mean z1 squared plus z2 squared plus z3 squared, is a constant, that's a two-sphere surface of a two-dimensional, it's a two-dimensional surface of a three-dimensional ball. And that's what it looks like. So in other words, g mu nu, this is a trivial example of a two-dimensional Euclidean space. It's not the four-dimensional space-time that we live in. It's just an example. So this is a squared sine squared theta. Or you can rewrite that as ds squared equals delta mu nu dx mu dx mu plus delta alpha beta x alpha delta gamma delta x gamma dx delta. And I missed out a dx beta term. All divided by a squared minus delta alpha beta x alpha x beta. This is what you get if you do the Cartesian version and impose this constraint. Now, I'm not going to do the calculation. I'll leave it to you as an exercise. calculate the Riemann tensor. In the case of spheres, the Riemann tensor takes a particularly simple form. It's just 1 over a squared times the product of the metric twice, g mu rho, g mu sigma, minus g mu sigma, g mu rho. This is an example of what's called a space of constant curvature. This is Riemann. Ricci is also simple. We just take the trace. And scalar. We take the trace again, but since we're in two dimensions, the trace of g is 2. That's 2 over a squared. For a space of constant curvature where the Riemann tensor is just given by the metric, since the metric has vanishing covariant derivative, so will the Riemann tensor. What do the geodesics look like? They look like great circles.
Mm-hmm. Is that the expression general or just for this piece?
This is for a two-dimensional sphere. Well, probably it works for higher dimensional spheres. But I haven't checked that. So it's designed to be the answer for the two-dimensional sphere. So let's summarize this differential geometry section. What have we encountered? We've encountered a metric, g mu nu of x, a connection, gamma mu rho sigma of x, and a Riemann tensor, r rho mu mu sigma of x. Were they tensors? This one is, this one isn't, this one is. What role do they play? The metric tells us how far apart two points are in the curved space-time. Gamma was built out of G. and its first derivatives. So it isn't a tensor. And Riemann is built out of gamma and its first derivatives. What are the significance of these tensors or not tensors? Space-time is curved. If and only if r, rho, mu, sigma is not equal to zero. In this case, we can never find a coordinate system with G mu nu is the Minkowski metric everywhere. Similarly, we can never find a coordinate system in which gamma is zero everywhere. But can construct locally inertial frames or the freely falling frame such that at a point P, so that the metric at that point, and let me write symbolically G mu nu P, which means G mu nu of x evaluated at the point x equals P, is eta mu nu. The first derivative is zero, and that's true of gamma. In fact, you can Taylor expand G about the point x equals P. And it turns out that the next term is R alpha mu beta nu plus R alpha nu beta nu. And we can invert that to write Riemann in terms of G comma rho. So that's about space-time is curved. Space-time is flat if and only if the Riemann tensor vanishes everywhere. One's tempted to say that means there's no gravitational field, but strictly speaking, it means there's no inhomogeneous gravitational field. Can find a coordinate system for which G mu nu is E to mu nu and gamma zero everywhere. Now, if we see a G that is not equal to Minkowski, it doesn't mean space is curved. If the Riemann tensor is zero, however, it means we can always find a coordinate system in which we can transform it so that it looks like Minkowski. Good. So that concludes the section on differential geometry. I'll pause for questions before we move on. Yes?
So the four velocity you wrote down above you, why did we not need a covariant derivative for that one? So u is defined there as the derivative of x mu with respect to s.
Yes.
But why is that a tensor? We just saw that such a thing in general is not a tensor.
Well, x mu is not a vector, remember. So this is dx mu is the vector. So dx mu ds is a tensor. This is compatible with the statement that dx mu ds is not a tensor, and it's compatible with the statement that d2x mu ds squared is not a tensor. But that is a tensor equation, vector equals vector. Any other questions? Okay, so now we're going to move on to section 3 of the lecture course, which is Einstein's equations. This is what all this tensor algebra has been leading up to. Einstein's equations rely on Riemannian geometry, so we have to do Riemannian geometry. But having done it, we can now use it to do the physics. This is part 3, Einstein's equations. Is the derivation of Einstein's equations. And the question we're asking is, we've decided that bodies moving in a curved space-time, their trajectories are determined by the metric tensor. Different metric, different motion. But the question we haven't yet addressed is, what determines the metric itself? What are the dynamics of the gravitational field, g mu nu itself? So given that gravity is described by a metric, how is what determines what the metric is? Well, Einstein said, whatever it is, whatever this equation we're looking for is, it has to reduce to what we know to be true, Newton's law. When the velocities are small compared to the velocity of light, and when the gravitational fields are weak. Because we know that Newton's law works well in that regime. So what does that mean? It means the first condition means dx by ds is smaller than dt by ds. And this means, this is what this condition means. What does the fields are weak mean? It means if we write the metric as the Minkowski metric plus a deviation from the Minkowski metric, then the size of that deviation must be small.
Would you mind explaining why the condition you wrote under V much less than C is implied by V much less than C?
Well, ds squared is c squared dt squared minus dx squared, which is approximately c squared dt squared in this regime. So dx by ds squared is less than dt by ds squared. That's what we mean by low velocity. So let's look at the geodesic equation. In the regime where the gravitational field is weak. Reduces to d2 x mu by ds squared plus gamma mu naught naught dx naught ds squared. I've not yet used the weakness, I've used the low velocity approximation. Now we're going to let g mu nu comma 0 equal 0 so that the field is time independent. What's behind this logic is to try and compare it with Newton's law. In that case, gamma mu naught naught is just minus 1/2 g mu nu d g naught naught dx nu. And now, if the field is weak, this is the same as minus 1/2 eta mu nu dh naught naught dx mu. So putting all this together, we find that d2x ds squared equals minus 1/2 dt by ds squared gradient of h naught naught, and d2t ds squared equals 0. So we can write this as minus 1/2 gradient . So we can now compare this with Newton's law. Which says d2x dt squared is minus the gradient of some potential phi. So it's looking like Newton's law. Let's just remind ourselves in Newton's theory what that potential phi looks like. For a spherical body of mass big M, phi is as a 1 over r potential minus gm over r. So by comparison, we learn that h naught naught equals 2 phi plus a constant, and so g naught naught is minus 1 p plus 2 phi. Now here I have to get my signature correct. Plus the constant. Let me leave it like that for a moment. Since we want the metric to tend to the Minkowski metric at infinity, we put the constant equals zero. I think I want a minus sign if I'm in the Weinberg's metric. Yes?
I have a question that was asked a little while there. When you introduce the H there,
yeah.
Would you mind explaining its role, what you're denoting by it?
We're going to look at gravitational fields that deviate from flat space by a small amount, which we're calling h mu nu. So the definition of h mu nu is g mu nu minus eta mu nu. And we've learned that if the geodesic equation is to reduce to the Newton's law, we have to identify h naught naught with twice the Newtonian potential. So g naught naught is minus 1 minus 2 phi. We can forget the constant because that we want this to tend to minus 1 at infinity. Let's just look at some examples. This is telling you by how much space-time is curved. It's curved by an amount. It's deviating from flat space by an amount phi. But for most purposes, phi is very small. For example, at the surface of a proton, phi is 10 to the minus 39. So to a very good approximation, space at the surface of a proton is flat. Then the surface of the Earth is 10 to the minus 9. So it's not zero, but it's small. At the surface of the Sun is 10 to the minus 6. At the surface of a white dwarf star, and you can all guess where it's equal to 1. That's at the surface of a black hole. So that gives you some feeling for how curved space is. The answer is not very much in our environment. But on astronomical scales, it is. And it becomes very strong when black holes are involved. So that's given us some relation between Newton's phi and Einstein's g. But we still haven't addressed the question of what determines g. Yeah.
Going from h naught naught to g naught naught.
Yeah.
Phi, 2 phi went to minus 2 phi. Why the minus sign in front of the phi?
I guess I should have put a minus sign there. It's a question of, for some reason in the notes I had, I was in metric 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, whereas we've been using minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So,
um,
I know for a fact that G naught naught for a black hole is minus 1 minus 2 gm over r, which is minus 1 plus 2 gm over r, which is minus 1 minus 2 phi. So this has to be correct. So I guess in order for that to be correct, I need a minus sign there. Now, we still haven't decided what determines G. It has to be something that reduces to Newton's law for phi. Newton's law for phi was some Poisson equation. So we're looking for something that reduces to that in the appropriate limits. And this is where the Bianchi identities will come in. As I indicated they would at the time we introduced the Ricci tensor and the Einstein tensor. So we begin by recalling the Newtonian result that del squared phi is 4 pi g rho, where rho is the mass density. This is what Newton says. Now, have you encountered in your other lectures the energy momentum tensor? Maybe if we haven't, we'll spend some more time in a different lecture. But for now, I just want you to recall or accept that for non-relativistic matter, rho is the naught-naught component of the energy momentum tensor. The energy momentum tensor is a 4x4 matrix, a symmetric tensor, and its naught-naught component is the energy density. So, we're looking for some equation for G mu nu that in the appropriate limits reduces to del squared phi is 4 pi g times t naught naught. So we're going to, if it's going to be a tensor equation, it has to involve all the components. Some tensor x mu nu is minus 8 pi g t mu nu. We haven't yet said what x is. Something built out of the metric, something built out of phi in the Newtonian case or out of g mu nu in the Einstein case is 8 pi g t mu nu. Now, Newton's law and all the other Maxwell's equations and all the other equations we're familiar with are limited to the differential equations of second order. We don't have third order derivatives. So we're going to restrict our attention to be x mu nu is some tensor built out of the metric and its first and second derivatives, but not higher. So by a process of elimination, we're going to narrow down what x is. Yeah?
Sorry, why does it have to be built on only the first and second derivatives of g as well as g? Why not the third or fourth and fifth derivatives?
Good question. The general covariance does not prevent us from having arbitrarily high numbers of derivatives. And in fact, in quantum gravity, you're forced to look at Lagrangians where you involve not only the metric in its first and second derivatives, but higher derivatives. We're not yet doing quantum gravity. We want to be write down an equation which will be valid in the classical regime, so it will describe planets and stars and things like that, and reduce to Newton's equations in the appropriate limit. And for that reason, we're going to restrict our attention to differential equations involving no more than second derivatives. Now, there's another reason, technical reason, which is to do with consistency of your equations. To have well-posed differential equations, you can run into trouble when you have more than two derivatives. But for now, it's a simplifying assumption. There's no golden rule or guiding principle that says it has to be, but it's a simplifying assumption. In Einstein's case, he was just trying to get Newton's laws, which themselves don't involve more than two derivatives. So that was what he was doing. But again, that doesn't rule out, there's no principle that rules out higher order corrections that vanish in the Newtonian limit. That would be equally as good. But for simplicity, we're not going to consider those. So what are the possibilities if we assume no more than two derivatives? Well, there are only two tensors available. One is the Ricci tensor, and the other is the Ricci tensor, the metric tensor times the curvature scalar. Actually, there's the third one, which would be proportional to the metric itself. I'll come back to that in a minute. But Einstein did not, following the historical route, this is what he did to begin with. Now, I mentioned this cartoon where he writes various fractions for A and B before he crosses them out, before arriving at the right one. The right one is fixed by the Bianchi identities, as it turns out, because if we take the covariant derivative of x, this will be A r mu nu semicolon alpha plus B r g has vanishing covariant derivative, so that stays as g. And then we have r comma alpha. we're going to put that equal to zero so as to be compatible with the fact that we want the energy momentum tensor. I'm sorry, I've rewritten this. Let me erase this and rewrite it. It's important that the covariant derivative be contracted with one of the indices, so I'm going to write it upstairs is A R mu nu semicolon mu plus B G mu nu semicolon mu. So as to be compatible with the fact that the energy momentum tensor has to have vanishing covariant derivative in order to be compatible with energy momentum conservation in the flat space limit. But this is where the Bianchi identities come in, because there was a very special combination of R mu nu, G mu nu, and R that did have vanishing covariant derivative. So it implies that X mu nu must be A times G mu nu, where G mu nu was the Einstein tensor. Which is, has the magic factor 1/2 G mu nu R. This satisfies the Bianchi identity, G mu nu semicolon mu equals zero. And you see the point I was making in an earlier lecture, that this was the result of rather abstract Riemannian geometry, forces to conclude that this was identically conserved. The conservation of energy and momentum is, by contrast, a very physical concept, which we carry over to the curved space case by replacing ordinary derivative by a covariant one. And yet, we've seen that the two are related, and that we are forced, in looking for the right equation for gravity, to make it the Einstein tensor. And to fix A, we go to the weak limit again. So R equals 8 pi G We take the trace, we get R minus 4 over 2, so that's minus R equals 8 pi g times A is 8 pi g t mu nu g mu nu, which is approximately equal to 8 pi g T naught naught. So R naught naught is approximately gamma I naught naught comma I, which is minus grad squared phi. And G naught naught is approximately del squared G naught naught, which is 2 del squared phi, which is 8 pi G rho, which implies A equals 1. So to summarize, we've derived Einstein's equations by requiring they reduce to Newton's equations. And we imposed the Bianchi identity to ensure that it was this combination of Ricci tensors which sits on the left-hand side. Yeah.
Do you mind explaining how that line begins with, it looks like negative AR, is implied by the weak gravity limit?
This says to fix A.
Yes.
Coefficient A.
How does that equation come from the weak gravity limit? Is it just what comes later is in the application of the...
I'm sorry, the weak limit. The first line does not involve the weak limit. I've just taken the trace of the equation. Then I've imposed the weak limit to replace... I've imposed the non-relative... Okay. I should make clear which limits are going on, shouldn't I? So first of all, take the trace. Then we take the non-relativistic limit. To replace T mu mu G mu mu by T naught naught. Then I take the weak limit. So I've done three steps. First of all, I took the trace of the equation with no limits, and I looked at the non-relativistic limit, then I took the weak limit. But this is the all-important result on which the whole of general relativity is based. This is Einstein's equations, and it tells us, as Einstein put it, there's marble on one side and base wood on the other. The marble is the geometry, the Riemannian geometry, embodied in the G mu nu. The T mu nu is built out of the stuff of which the universe is made. Elementary particles, atoms, planets, galaxies, all sit on the right-hand side. And as John Wheeler put it, matter tells space how to curve. Space tells matter how to move, or words to that effect. But these are very non-linear differential equations. G mu nu, you remember, is built out of R mu nu. R mu nu is built out of the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor is built out of gammas. And gammas involved inverse metrics, so it's a very non-linear set of differential equations, but it's a second-order differential equations. And what we're going to be focusing on next is how to solve these equations. Let me just make one final remark. He could have added a term plus lambda g mu nu, well, to the left-hand side, plus lambda g mu nu, a constant times the metric. That would have complied with all the requirements of general covariance, it would give you a term that isn't in Newton's laws. But if lambda was sufficiently small, it may still be allowed. Now, Einstein put in such a term, then he took it out again for all the wrong reasons, as we'll see. He put it in because he thought the universe was static and that the stars were fixed in the sky. And then he later learned in the work of Hubble that the universe was expanding. And so he put the lambda back in again. And lambda's been going in and out of fashion for the last 100 years, but it's now definitely there. We know from recent observations of receding galaxies that there definitely is a cosmological constant, albeit a small one. So, and there's no principle to rule it out. So, really, the question should not be why should we put it in, but why should we leave it out? Because general covariance is perfectly compatible with such a constant. Okay, see you tomorrow.